Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. Welcome to episode two. This is your host, Alan Lee. And today we're going to be talking about a topic very near and dear to my heart, for the last couple of years at least, investment banking. As always, if you have any questions or comments or want to look at the show notes, please feel free to visit my website, www.thevampiresquid.com. I think the best way to structure this episode is to provide an overview of what an investment bank does, the positions, the details, the nuances, then provide my experience in investment banking before talking about what investment bankers do after they finish their tenure in investment banking. I think it's worth it to start off in the overview as well as provide clarification between retail banks and investment banks. So a retail bank is what you see down your street with an ATM. This is your Chase Bank, or this is your Bank of America. They focus on lending and deposits, and they make their money mostly off of charging fees on the lending. An investment bank, on the other hand, focuses mostly on clients that are institutional. So these could be large companies, these could be other financial firms. So they focus on institutional clients and provide them with services like IPOs, M&As, LBOs, and an IPO is initial public offering, basically when a company goes public. M&A is a merger and acquisition, the buying and selling of companies. They also help with debt financing, basically helping companies raise capital. These are what investment banks do. And within investment banks, you also have something called bulge bracket banks and boutique banks. So bulge bracket banks are the ones that most people outside of finance probably know about. These are the Goldmans, the Morgan Stanleys, the JP Morgans. These are usually the larger banks that have a full suite of offerings in terms of the services they provide. So the IPO, M&A, debt financing, etc. Boutique banks are things like Greenhill, Cowen, Catalyst, Moelis. These are some of the smaller banks that focus on M&A transactions. That's usually the main distinction, and these banks are definitely a little bit smaller than the bulge brackets. Now, in any investment bank, the positions usually are some variation of the following. There's an analyst that's usually a 2 to 3 year program. There's the associate that's a 3 to 4 year program. There's a vice president that could be 4 to 6 year program before you become a managing director. And a managing director, you can stay there for quite a while, or some people that bring in the most revenue or some of the managing directors that have the most relationships, they sometimes get promoted to partner, which is the highest level within the investment banking division. Now, in terms of what these positions do, a brief summary is the analyst does most of the grunt work, making the presentations, building the Excel model. The associate also helps a lot with the grunt work, but they do a little bit more of the checking. The vice president helps manage the analyst and associate in terms of getting stuff done on time. The vice president also manages the client most of the times too, in terms of working with them to make sure we get them what they want. And the vice president also manages the managing director in terms of letting them know how the analyst and associate are doing and managing their expectations as well. And the managing director, as previously mentioned, is the one with the relationship. So they're the ones mostly engaging with the client. And in terms of how hands-on or hands-off, they may or may not provide guidance in terms of the materials that needs to be done for the upcoming meeting or project. Partners are basically managing directors, but they're usually a little bit more hands-off, but have more relationships and engage with the client a little bit more often. So the analyst role also has been changing quite rapidly over the last couple years. There's a big competition for junior talent nowadays, and a lot of analysts are leaving for, you know, other financial firms or technology firms or Fortune 500 firms because they maybe want more responsibility, they want more money, they just want something that isn't provided by the investment bank. So at least what Goldman has been doing is they've recently been promoting analysts immediately after the 2 years. Usually it's a 3-year analyst program before you get promoted to associate, but they basically bumped up everything a year. So you get technically more responsibility and more pay at an earlier stage in your career, which I think is a pretty good initiative. And I think a lot of other investment banks are following suit in terms of promoting analysts a little bit quicker, because if you think about it, investment banks spend a lot of money and time for training analysts and going through another hiring process of, you know, finding new analysts is quite lengthy and time consuming, and it costs a lot of money. So they'd rather retain their talent instead of trying to find new talent every year. So what does an investment bank do? I think I like to compare it to a consulting firm, because everyone, I think, understands what consulting firms do. It's a consulting firm has a project or assignment from a client, and, you know, they make an action or they make a plan and recommend it to their client. And that's usually it. That's where it stops. An investment bank does something very similar. They do provide advice to their clients, but they usually do it through more of a financial lens. So using Excel a lot more, providing valuation advice, and they actually see the deal through to the very end. So if a company's going public, an investment bank's not going to recommend them go public and that's it. An investment bank is going to take them through every step of the way until the company's public. And even after they're public, they still maintain a relationship with the client and provide them with other services that they need. So an investment bank is something that sees usually the entire process or deal till the very end. In terms of dress code, this is highly dependent on your location and your group. For SF and LA, so the West Coast, which is a little bit more lax, our dress code is you have your dress shoes, slacks, a belt, button-down shirt, and a mandatory Patagonia or Vineyard Vines vest. This is the mandatory dress code for guys on the West Coast. On the East Coast, it's a little bit more formal, and you have usually a full suit on. And if you're in a group that is a little bit more formal, and when I say group, I mean certain sector that focuses on a certain industry. So there's a technology group in investment banking. There's a retail group in investment banking. There's a healthcare group in investment banking. So depending on which group, some are more intense about dress than others. You might have to wear a suit and tie every day. And in terms of when people get in for work, people usually show up, at least for your first year, sometime before 9 to 9:30. If you're in your second year, it's a little bit more lax. So you might show up anytime between 9:30 to 11. If you had a really late night, you might even show up sometime before 12. And something that's pretty cool about Goldman, at least, is in terms of weekends, we don't work Saturdays unless there's an exception. So technically, you have every Saturday off where you don't have to check any emails or respond to any emails unless there's an exception. An exception is basically if you're on a live deal and there needs to be work on that Saturday, and you have to go through this formal process of getting it approved by a bunch of higher up people for you to work Saturdays. That's the only time you'd ever work on Saturdays. And I know a bunch of other investment banks have something similar to this. Some do one weekend off a month, but some variation of the sort. This is to basically improve junior retention and make sure we get some rest, at least. And this is pretty recent. I think this initiative only started a couple years ago, but it has been very effective, at least at Goldman. Now, in terms of my experience, I have a few questions that people constantly ask me that I would like to share with all of you. That's very helpful. So a lot of people ask, what are your hours like? I will give the best case scenario of my hours and the worst case scenario, and then you can draw your conclusions that most of my time is somewhere in between there. So my best case scenario is something like this. I'll wake up at 9:30 a.m., check my email, don't have any emails from the client or team members, and wake up, brush my teeth, hit the shower, eat some breakfast, and go to the gym at 10:30. Go to the gym for half an hour, stroll into work sometime before noon, and stop by a friend's desk and chit-chat, catch up on the weekend, talk about Game of Thrones, and then go pick up lunch somewhere and eat outside of the office. So typically, we usually bring our lunch back, but today is a really good day. So I'm eating outside of the office with my friend, maybe another friend from another bank or another firm comes join us, finish lunch at 1:30, something like that, or maybe 2, come back, read some news, check my email, still no emails. A friend wants to get an acai bowl at Blue Hawaii, I'm down, we go do that. Another friend wants to go get a beer after, I'll go do that. And we get a dinner stipend at 6 p.m., so I may or may not come back for the dinner stipend, which is basically $25 that you get to spend towards dinner if you stay till 6. And if I do or do not decide to do that, I'll go home afterwards and maybe watch a few episodes of Silicon Valley and then go to sleep. That is the best case scenario. Now for the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario goes something like this. It's 6:30 a.m. and my associate and VP and I are all sitting in our sort of cubicle area. I'm cranking through this 20-tab Excel model with hundreds of assumptions and dozens of scenarios that need to be modeled out. My associate's making edits to the PowerPoint presentation and making other charts for analysis. The VP is reviewing the work and making comments and live edits to the presentation and the model. We get a call at 7 a.m. This is a client. They want to see where we are, even though we're not finished with our work. We send them what we currently have. They provide comments and note that it has to be due at, you know, maybe 4 p.m. that same day. We're going to work all the way till 4 p.m., skip breakfast, skip lunch. If someone's really nice, they might bring us a smoothie because we just look like we haven't slept in days, which is true because this is the fourth or fifth day that we've been working nonstop, and we may have gotten maybe 6 hours of sleep in the last 4 days, and that's not an exaggeration. So an average of an hour and a half a night, but usually there's a couple of all-nighters in there, so probably 3 hours of sleep one night, an all-nighter, 3 hours of sleep the next night, all-nighter. So now it's 4 p.m. We're only 70% of the way through. Now our MD gets upset, which is our managing director, because we don't have what we can deliver to the client on time. And we get a group meeting and a talking to about how we need to make sure we get this work on time. We continue working. And right now we're functioning at about 10% of full capacity, having not slept and just working nonstop. Finally, we're nearing the end. It's around 9 or 10 p.m. now, and there's the final few edits to make. So the managing director's at home, but he calls in and tells the associate or VP and VP to go home because they just have not slept at all. And I can just make some of these final edits because I'm the analyst and send it off to the client. Client calls maybe half an hour after the vice president and the associate leaves, asking for further changes to be done that will take another 2 hours. So I'm there till midnight again. And finally, we might send it off sometime around 1 a.m. And that is probably the worst experience or the worst hours that I've experienced. And I'm sure a lot of investment banking analysts have had something, at least if not worse, something very similar to what I just described. Now, these are the extreme case scenarios of both ends. So something is usually in between, but that's the extent of how bad an investment banking analyst career can get, or how bad their time can get. Also, the other thing I get is, you know, what do you do on a day-to-day basis? On a day-to-day basis, I am in Outlook a lot, which is our email client that is powered by Microsoft. We can get anywhere from 5 emails a day to 500, and that's not an exaggeration, probably sometimes more than 500 emails a day. We work a lot in PowerPoint, which is used to create the presentations for the meetings, and we work a lot in Excel, which is to do financial modeling. And what that means is basically putting into an Excel sheet the numbers that are used for a type of scenario. So for example, if a company is buying another company, which is called M&A, there might be an Excel model for that, showing one company's financials, the buyer's, the seller's company's financials, and then the pro forma, which is the combined financials, because you want to see what the company looks like combined together. And this is done in an Excel model. So we use these tools a lot, and I think the majority of our time is spent preparing for meetings, which can be a meeting with the board, a meeting with the CEO, a meeting with the corporate development vice president. And these meetings range from anything from potential capital restructures, and what that means is something like a company deciding to do a stock buyback or issue a dividend. We might do a meeting about M&A ideas, which is basically showing the client potential targets that they could look at acquiring. Another one is activist defense. Activist defense is protecting against hedge funds that like taking a very active role in your company. And you probably have a good amount of experience or read in the news about activists. So Carl Icahn was an activist in Apple. There was an activist in Yahoo that replaced their former CEO and replaced him with Marissa Mayer. And with these subjects, we'll dive into much more deeply in further episodes, because each of them could take up, you know, hours standalone. So we use those tools mostly on a day-to-day basis. We prepare for meetings on a day-to-day basis. We also, if it's a live deal, then we'll focus mainly on that. A live deal means a deal that is mandated by the client. So the client has officially asked us to represent them in X transaction, which is an IPO or an M&A or debt financing. And we focus a lot working with that client, because it's something that's, you know, going to come to fruition. So we'll engage with the client a lot in those types of scenarios. So having calls and having a lot of meetings with them to make sure we have all the right information, to make sure we're doing what they want us to do in terms of, you know, getting the right materials done on time, the right analysis done on time. Some of the other things that I do on a day-to-day basis, I read the news a lot, read a lot of tech, and read a lot of financial news in the Wall Street Journal, Deal Book. We'll also grab lunch with colleagues, eat dinner. So, I mean, the day depends highly on if you're in a live deal or not, and if you have an upcoming meeting or not. And if you do, it's usually a little bit more busy. If you don't, it's usually a little bit more lax. I also get a question of, you know, what are the investment banking perks? What are the benefits, some of the smaller things that you guys get? For investment bankers, everyone is issued an Amex corporate card. And this Amex corporate card is used for all your dinner and meal expenses and for your travel expenses. So we get $25 for dinner. And after midnight, we get another $25. And every 4 hours after that, we get another $25. So we get one at midnight, we get one at 4 a.m., we get one at 8 a.m., and it continues on depends on how long you stay. But usually people don't fully utilize that because they're not thinking about eating a cheeseburger at 4 a.m., but they're just trying to get home. We get also car service after 10 p.m. at night. So we get to take a Uber home after 10 p.m., and we can take whatever type of Uber we want. We can take a black car, We can take a regular Uber. We can take a Uber SUV. I don't think anyone's taken an Uber copter as of yet, but you know, maybe they have. And on the weekends, we also get car service to and from work. So we get to the free car to work and from work, and we get a $75 meal stipend if we work on the weekends. And this is per day. Also, if you fly over 2,000 miles, you get to fly business class. So when we go from SF to New York, we get to fly business class. And this is, we usually take a red eye, so a flight at 10 or 11 p.m. from SF and get into New York at 6 or 7 a.m. So it's pretty crucial because we finally get to sleep. We also get car service to and from client sites. So we had a lot of meetings in San Jose and Mountain View, and we get to take a Uber down there. But sometimes, especially during traffic hour, it could take 2 hours to get there. And some of the Uber rides that we've had cost upwards of $250 per Uber ride, which is an insane amount for just one ride. But that's an example of one of the expenses that we've had. We at Goldman, we've introduced happy hours every Friday. I know a lot of other investment banks do that as well. And data rooms. So data room providers are companies that provide data rooms to investment banks and to their clients. And the reason we need a data room is if an investment bank is helping a company go through an M&A transaction. So say I'm helping sell company B to company A. A data room is what contains all the company information in terms of the financial info, the company contracts, the termination agreements, the employee agreements. All those files are stored in this data room, which is a very secure online, you can think of it almost like a Dropbox, a secure online data room that both parties can access so that they can do their due diligence. And this is what it means when they're doing due diligence. It's basically when the buyer is evaluating the company, reading through these documents before they make their decision whether or not they want to buy this company. So these data rooms obviously want our business because we help decide what data room to choose from. And there's, I think, 5, 6, or 7 large data room providers. So they provide a lot of perks, especially towards the analysts, because we are the ones, you know, comparing the data rooms and have a lot of say sometimes. So what data rooms do is they host a lot of things like happy hours. They come to our office and give us free lunch. Some of them do sushi nights. Some I've heard buy bottles at clubs for you. You get tickets to Beyonce concerts, to Warriors games, to SF Giant games. There's a lot of freebies that data rooms provide in the hopes that they win your business because of these perks that they give you. And also, I think probably the last thing that investment bankers get is you get something called Lucites, which are basically a deal toy every time you finish a deal. So if you finished an IPO, you might get basically this plastic or this glass deal toy, which has the name of the company, your investment bank's name on it, the size of the IPO offering, and the date. So it's something to basically remember the deal by, which is pretty cool to have and remember your deal. Also, people really like to ask me, you know, what are the things you like about investment banking? So I think to start off in the very beginning, training was a pretty cool experience. And I say training with quotation marks because it's a month and a half in New York where every investment banker from all around the world congregate. And you learn about financial modeling, you learn about SEC regulations, you learn about financial statements, but most of the time it's just a lot of partying and making new friends, which is probably a pretty underrated part of investment banking that people don't usually talk about. Next thing I liked were, for the most part, the people were, you know, very caring, intelligent, and respectable. I had a very good experience for the most part with the people that I've worked with and my fellow colleagues in investment banking. I also really liked being able to evaluate companies and compare them with other companies, to do Excel models quickly to come up with my own hypothesis on a company, or making a presentation in a very clear and concise format that's easy to read and understand, which I think is a valuable skill in whatever job you choose to pursue next. Also, I think another really underrated part is the late night bonding that you have with your analysts. So I like to think of it as sort of pledging a fraternity. You don't really get close to people unless you go through hell with them or you've had an experience with them that is very memorable. And for our case, it could be something like ordering a dessert pizza at 4 a.m. with Crystal Geyser lemon water, and you're throwing a football around, blasting Avicii in the background while you're trying to finish this Excel model or this PowerPoint presentation for a meeting tomorrow. Those are the nights where you have late night conversations and you get to really bond with your fellow analysts. So that's probably one of my favorite things that I liked about investment banking. And also, on the contrary, people ask me, what are things you don't like? Okay, so as I mentioned before, for the most part, a lot of the people were caring and intelligent, but some of the people didn't really have that much respect for junior people's time, and they didn't really understand the magnitude of some of the things they asked us to do. So they might ask us to do something that might take 10 hours, but they would ask for it to be due within 5 hours. And it was very comical because we'd always make jokes about certain senior bankers that do things like this, and we'd say, "Hey, I know it's already 10 p.m., and I don't want you to stay here past midnight, but I'm going to need this 40-page presentation due on my desk tomorrow at 8 a.m. Obviously, it's not exactly that extreme, but you get the point. Another thing that I had to take a little bit of getting used to were the workplace politics. And I haven't really worked at another firm for an extended period of time, so maybe it's the same at other places, maybe it's not, but workplace politics were pretty prevalent in investment banking. So these are things like getting coffee with the right people, maybe sort of sucking up to decision makers at the firm. And I know even some people filtered their email based on the seniority of the sender. So if your managing director is sending an email, it's at the top of your inbox. But if an analyst is sending an email, it's at the very bottom of the inbox where you might not even read it till the next day or something like that. That was something that took a little bit of getting used to, workplace politics. The other thing is some of the work is just not stimulating. For example, one of the things that we had to do is something called company profiles. And this is when you present a lot of ideas to a certain client. So the client may be looking for an acquisition target. So you present them with maybe 40, 50, 60, 70 different names that they could look at into acquiring. But with each of these names, you have to create a company profile. And what that means is you have to get the logo of the company. If they're public, you get the market cap. If they're private, you get the venture capital investors. You write a summary of the company. You write who the CEO is, who the CFO is, who the decision makers are, who's on the board. And the worst that I've had to do, I had to make an entire PowerPoint presentation with 30 pages of company profiles. And each page has maybe 3 to 4 companies on it. So 120 plus company profiles. And you could probably imagine how long that would take and how unstimulating that type of work can be. And we call these picture books. So whenever someone's making a book with just company profiles, we make fun of them and say, "Hey, how's the picture book going?" And the last thing is probably What I didn't really enjoy was the unpredictability of the hours and the stress. Because our work is client-based, we have to do whatever the client asks us to do. So if it's Wednesday and the client needs something on Thursday morning, we're going to have to stay all night to get that work done. So that's one of the other things that isn't that enjoyable about investment banking. So I think that's a fairly comprehensive summary of investment banking. And I think what we'll talk about next is, you know, what people do after investment banking. Right when you start investment banking, you get contacted by something called headhunters. And these are basically people that try to match you with jobs at other firms. So they start meeting with you almost immediately when you start working, and they try to match you with private equity firms, hedge funds, Fortune 500 companies, startups, and you do meetings with them and tell them your preference of what you want to work, where you want to work, etc., and they try to help place you. So in terms of private equity recruiting, this is probably the earliest recruiting. This happens in January, which is about 5-6 months after you start, and because you usually start in August, and you recruit for private equity jobs that happen 2 years later. So if it's August 2015, in January of 2016, I'll have my job for the summer of 2017 already. And some of the hedge funds also recruit on the private equity timeline, but they also recruit on a need-to-have basis, as well as with corporate Fortune 500 companies and startups. They recruit all throughout the year, and they send you LinkedIn requests or headhunters contact you about jobs within these firms as well. So these are what people do after investment banking if they choose not to stay in it. And I think the breakdown is something like 80 to 90% of people leave, maybe 10% stay. And the breakdown between private equity, hedge funds, corporate, and startups, I think a majority still probably go into private equity, which is about 30 to 40%. About 10 to 20% might go into hedge funds, 10% stay, and then the remaining go into Fortune 500 companies or tech startups. So all in all, I think that I'm pretty glad that I did investment banking out of college. I thought it provided me with a very tangible skill set and a very transferable skill set into, you know, whatever I want to do long term. And I'm currently not sure exactly what I want to do in the very long term, but I think that my career in investment banking, or my tenure there the last couple of years, has been useful, and I think it will be applicable in whatever I choose to do. So if you have any further questions or comments, things you want to get off your chest or ask me about my experience in investment banking, please go to my website, www.thevampiresquid.com, and you can go to the podcast tab and click on this show and get the show notes and comment on questions, and I'll do my best to respond as quickly as possible. You can always email me directly as well at Alan, A-L-A-N, at thevampiresquid.com. And also, if you guys like this podcast or have any suggestions, please leave me a review on iTunes or on Google, Android. That would be very helpful in terms of getting feedback and getting the show a little bit more promoted. I would love to provide a lot more interesting and valuable content for my listeners. But until next time, thank you all for listening, and see you on the next episode of The Vampire Squid.